Hey everyone, this is Pepin Middlehauser, host of the Next Wave Radio Hour, and I am very happy to introduce to you all today a new addition to the host lineup on Next Wave Radio, Elizabeth Walstoney. Elizabeth is a journalist with the Bangor Daily News and a DJ on WERU's show Americana Basement on Saturdays, among many other things. But without further ado, I'll pass it over to Elizabeth.
Welcome to the Next Wave Radio Hour from WERU Community Radio, a program featuring folks in their 20s and 30s from across Maine. I'm your host, Elizabeth Walstoney, and in this show, I'll provide you with unique perspectives of life from the next generation, working to create the future they hope to see in Maine. My guest today is Jonathan Riley. He's a poet, writing teacher, local news reporter, and a good friend. Jonathan, thank you for being on the show today.
It is an absolute pleasure to be here with you, a good friend. And a fellow
imagine
writer.
That.
Thank you for having me.
So as some background for our listeners, I was a general assignment reporter at the Lincoln County News until recently, and Jonathan and I worked there together. You're just coming up on your year anniversary there. And I know you also do a lot of other things, especially in the writing world. Can you tell us what an average week is like for you and all the activities that you have?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're absolutely right. We just crossed the threshold of 1 year at the paper. And that, aside from the daily sort of exercises in journalism, because community journalism is a lot of fun, but it's a lot of fun because it's hard and it's involved. Aside from my work life, I am fairly involved in the poetry community in New England. My master's degree is in poetry that I received from the University of New Hampshire, which I graduated from a year ago, and that opportunity allowed me to teach poetry at a high level at the university level. And that, you know, became a sort of a recognition of a calling. And that in my weekly life has been, you know, I don't get to teach as often as I like, but I do now get to, I still tutor. I still write poetry, you know, every day, at least a little something. I try to do a little sonnet at the end of my days in order to fit in something, you know, as far as creativity goes. And, you know, outside of that, you know, it's amazing how much the job as a reporter and journalist has taken my week by storm. And so, you know, outside of that, outside of my writing life, you know, and I do, you know, on a weekly basis, sort of shop around my manuscript and different poems that I'm moving around in my head. And but outside of that, I am a bartender, and I've been a bartender for a long time, since I was 19, 20, and now I just moonlight as a bartender for weddings on the weekends, and sometimes for celebrations of life. So I, you know, whether it's in love or life or death, you know, I'm there serving a drink.
The weekly life of working at the newspaper is really consuming and really special. So I was hoping maybe you could detail that a little bit for our listeners.
And yeah, absolutely.
And also kind of illustrate how you really work to keep your poetry life alive at the same time.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So in a week at the paper, our week starts at 11 o'clock on Wednesdays. And we go to print, you know, by the following Wednesday at 9 a.m. So our week is broken up by the weekend, but it's a lot of planning ahead and making space not only for the interviews, but the time to sort of digest interviews with people. There's a, you know, it's hard not to feel like you're becoming a production writer in these moments, because you're dealing with people's lives and you're dealing with some of the most intimate moments. You know, you're celebrating them, the beginning of their, you know, they're opening a business, parades, you know, they're, and then we cover some of the sides of like being a community, you know, when accidents happen, you know, when things go awry in local politics. But we're there for both the celebration and those moments that are more difficult to cope with. And so carving out time for yourself, just as not just as a journalist, but as a human, to sort of digest those moments in their entirety in order to write something that's really perceptive and thoughtful is really important to me during the week. Now, it doesn't always, time doesn't always allow for that. I tend to mull pretty slowly. Sometimes I feel like I move at a glacial pace when I'm moving through an interview that was maybe 2 or 3 hours long, and that's not all of them. But you know, so you spend time creating time for your interviews, and then the time to digest it, and the time to write it. I was reading through the journalism textbook that you gave me, Community Journalism, and there's a really great line in there from the author about stories being perishable, and that is a really cool idea. For not just stories that we're writing about as journalists, but as poets, you know, ideas, as creatives, so that like things have a timeline, they have expiration dates, so you need to attend to them quickly. So that sort of urgency in reporting to get the story out while it's still living with you, when you come out of an interview, you know the feeling, like when you're so full of the other person's story, you're like, you're ready to gush about it. Those are moments that I really cherish, and I try to translate that into my creative life. So when I'm working, you know, sometimes I'll have an idea for a poem that I'll get back to. Sometimes a line shows up. It feels as though that my creative life, my personal life, have become like the cracks in my day that I fill, you know, the time left, I fill my moments of creativity. And so when we have select board meetings, we have municipal meetings that, you know, take up our evenings for Wednesday, Thursday, and sometimes Friday, and sometimes Monday and Tuesday, and sometimes we have stuff on, you know, the weekend. And so, you know, I had a really wonderful conversation with Don Kerrigan, who's a famous broadcaster in Maine. And he was talking about how you just, when he was coming up in the broadcasting scene in news in Maine, you know, when news happened, you would go to it. And that was just the job. And that's been really cool to be a part of, but it's also been difficult to fit myself in with that. But it's a worthy challenge, I think, of anyone, because I think really it's just emblematic of how anyone fits themselves into their daily lives.
I've always kind of wondered what it's like for you to be doing this really personal and involved job with people that you grew up with or grew up around. So for our listeners, the Lincoln County News is based in Newcastle, and Jonathan, you grew up in Bremen, went to school in Damariscotta, and you know a lot of people who live here, which is sometimes not always the case for our reporters. And so we'll get back into your life trajectory as the discussion goes. So that's also something that I want to talk about. But I'm wondering what it's like for you to be here again as an adult and kind of entering and processing people's lives in a different way.
Yeah, that's a really lovely question. The difference, I think, I've been able to recognize in externally in my interviews for a weekly column the paper has called Characters of the County. And I have had the good fortune of being able to write a handful of those profiles of people, featuring people in the county. And it's remarkable how many people left and came back. And almost to a person, they say, I wouldn't have appreciated this place had I not left. I really love that. When I graduated from Lincoln Academy in Newcastle, I was in Costa Rica for a while. And then I went and matriculated at Florida State University. And after Florida State University, I went and taught English in Vietnam. And slightly prior to the COVID pandemic, I came back to the States and came back to Maine and went to UNH. But so I had spent the better part of the last decade out and about, and being an adult, looking at the community that really afforded me those opportunities, it's just, I feel a lot of gratitude and I feel a lot of wonder and I feel a lot of awe, which are things that I don't think that I recognized growing up here. When I was growing up in high school, I like to say that this place is beautifully boring. In many ways it is. But as an adult, especially as a journalist now, I've come to appreciate so much how hard it is to make community work. And community as a verb has been really fantastic. And I feel like, because I had a great middle school, high school experience. I had a great childhood. I really had a lovely upbringing in this town. And that feeling of gratitude is like, keeps coming in waves. And as a journalist, you know, it's funny, writing about people you know about is really awesome. I love being able to celebrate people and even help people. But when I first started, I had no prior journalism experience, except reporting to like Facebook, Instagram. I was, you know, wherever I was in the world, you know, just writing little things on my statuses. So it was an immense, the responsibility I felt on my shoulders was twofold, because I wanted to, it, you know, would break my heart if I got things wrong about people that I love. And I really view the journalism, especially community journalism, as, you know, the eye of history. And when you get those things wrong, even those little details, it's significant. And I don't always get it right, but coming back, being a journalist in the community, it made me appreciate it, but it was a lot weightier as someone who grew up here, because, you know, I'd say half the time, two thirds of the time, I knew those people and I just want to help. And it always hurt when my, you know, negligence or the learning curve of the job, not to say that I made too many mistakes that have really like altered people's lives, like that's not what I was saying, but even just like leaving, you know, little details out, like it was, you know, their grandfather, not their father, that built the dock, like those little things. I just want to make sure that I get the story right, because it's important to get the story right, because, you know, as you know, as community journalists, you know, often we are the only time people get to interface with reporters, and I would hate to have their first interaction be with a reporter that gets it wrong. And so
I was curious about your experience or participation in the parts of being in community or maintaining a community that sometimes can be difficult, but in the long run they're worth it because everybody cares about what you're trying to do.
That's, you know, like we were just saying that, you know, not all of municipal workings is like warm and fuzzy, and there's a lot of contention, because democracy is the majority thought moving forward, but you have to listen to all parts, and it's like a slightly dysfunctional family, but with a common goal. It's hard. Community is hard. And like you had just said, like it's kind of a buzzword where it's this warm and fuzzy feeling, but that's the product. That's not the process. The process of community is hard and is rewarding. It is, 1,000%, as an adult, I can see why people, you know, as a kid, I could never really understand why people would put on like of community events and stuff. I'm like, that's lame. Like, whatever. I'm not going to go do that. I'm going to play Pokemon and fall out of a tree. You know, I'm going to go do kid stuff. But watching its necessity is like, you can feel the needs of a community, and, you know, and that's, it's really cool to see that. But you're right, the community is hard work. It's not warm and fuzzy. It's contentious sometimes, you know, because everyone has a different idea for the same goal. The goal always is for the best result for people, right? I like to think so. Some people may move in more self-serving ways, but ideally we're operating in a realm that is for the best of the community, which is the many. And many people have many ideas about how to do that. And that's democracy. And I know that you've done this as well. When before many of the select board meetings, you say the Pledge of Allegiance. Well, for a lot of towns, not every town, but most of the towns I cover say the Pledge of Allegiance before they get into the weekly, bi-weekly business. And that has been really funny to see my own patriotism sort of blossom, because it feels like we say this thesis statement at the beginning of democracy at its smallest points. And it's like, all right, I pledge allegiance to the flag, United States of America, and it's like, we're going to give it our best shot. That's what feels like we say at the beginning of each meeting, like, all right, remember, this is the people. Like, we're trying to make democracy work. This is just this huge historical, social experiment, democracy that is, there are varying opinions about how it's working, but to look at it work at its smallest points is very cool. And it has made me feel really proud to be a part of that, even when it's hard, especially when it's hard. And I don't think people appreciate that enough.
I saw that too through my time at paper, and it really did make me appreciate and understand a lot more, especially at the level where it's governing your small town or it's, you can see it very clearly. And you mentioned too about appreciating community events or things like that. I was reflecting on that the other day, that I love it now when parades come down Main Street. And it's kind of like emotionally affecting for me. And when I was a kid, I remember thinking, well, all right, I'll ride my tricycle down the street too or something. But it's like kind of means something now.
Right.
In a way that I can connect.
That is really, yeah, absolutely. The parades, I was hype as a kid, but now I'm even more hype. I'm like, yeah, let's go. Like, let's walk in the street. Let's get the fire department here. Let's make some noise. Let's throw some candy. Like, let's, that's so right. It's so wonderful to see those parts, because that's the celebration. It's not always fun like that, but it is it's fantastic, I think, to be a part of it. And sometimes when I'm sitting in those select board meetings, I recognize that democracy is hard, community is hard. Democracy is a type of community, and it's a type of process. And it's not always sexy. Democracy happens within a lot of pale walls, and watching people around the world in different cultures and countries, fight for their right to be heard and democratic processes in their governance is incredible. And it makes me chuckle sometimes, about the privilege of being able to sit within those pale walls and be like, I'm bored out of my mind. I'm just kidding. I am always 1000% attentive to what's happening.
Oh, yes.
In case my editors are listening or any of the select boards.
You're listening to the Next Wave Radio Hour from WERU with host Elizabeth Wallstoney and guest Jonathan Riley.
So as we've been talking about this, we've been touching on childhood and how things have changed or developed. So tell us a little bit about what you were like growing up and what your experiences were like here.
What I was like growing up? What was I like growing up? Oh, man. That was a good time. Are you kidding me? What was I like growing up? I felt shy initially. I have a mother and father who are very, both outgoing and perceptive and hilarious people. And I remember not finding that supernaturally as a kid. Supernaturally. Very naturally as a kid. Yeah. And having to work at it. My dad's side of the family is a big gregarious, redheaded Irish Catholic family. And we have sort of a smaller nucleus, but everyone's loud and fun. And I remember when I was like third or fourth grade wanting to be more like that. And so my life, you know, I remember joining choir around that age because I figured if I could sing, I could speak in front of people. And now I speak in front of people a lot, and I don't sing in front of people anymore. But I remember joining choir in third grade because of that. And yeah, I think as a kid, I was always, you know, rambunctious, but I always felt really deeply that I believed in people. I really loved interacting with people. And I used to, you know, hear stories from my dad about all the insane characters he's met along the way. And sometimes the end of that, those stories would be like, well, and we, you know, we fell out of touch. And I'm like, why would you ever do that? And so I remember as a kid making a concerted effort to be like, no, when I have a friend, they're stuck with me. And that's not how it's panned out. I, you know, didn't know about life yet. But I am lucky that I have many deep friendships that I've had for a while. But yeah, it's a funny question. What was I like as a kid? Young Johnny Riley was having a blast, but being an adult has been finding avenues to sort of temper that. I don't know. Sometimes I feel like I just have this inferno inside of me that's just really excited to like be around others and, you know, look at sunsets and write poetry and yell and laugh really loudly and just like not give a care about the volume of my life. But being an adult has been like learning when it's cool to do that. And not that, like, you know, I'm not saying I've changed myself for that, but I have like learned that, you know, it's a time, you know, knowing your audience is something that my dad used to say a lot when I was a kid. It's like, you know, if you know your audience, you know, you can do a lot. And so sometimes the audience doesn't need me laughing in the background. So, but yeah, I was super involved in high school and middle school. Was involved in, you know, student politics from as soon as I could be on student government. I wanted to be involved, and was involved in sports. Really valued the connection between the body and the mind. And yeah, I just wanted to be around people all the time. I knew from a young, I knew before I was literate that I wanted to be a writer. And I sort of found that naturally. I remember showing my parents scribbles. I would just like put these lines across the page because I was mimicking the act of writing. And I'd seen in an Arthur episode that that's how they would mimic writing in the classroom. And I would like show my parents that. And you know, my mom always read to us before bed. My dad's was an editorial cartoonist for a long time. So we grew up in a very creative household. My mom was a teacher for 20 years with a deep love of literature. And so, yeah, we would talk about politics. We, you know, we aren't a, we're a very spiritual group. We're Unitarian Universalists, but we, instead of saying grace before dinner every night, we would say, we would choose something good in someone's day around the table, and we would toast to that, and we would cheers. And so that was really wonderful, positive orientation as a child, trying to see the brighter things.
After high school, you chose to go to college outside of Maine. And tell us a bit about why you did that and how it kind of played a role in you becoming who you are.
Yeah, that's a great question. I knew that if I, because I, from being so involved with sports and student government and different community things, I had a lot of friends and I was full of shenanigans. And I knew, if I went to the University of Maine, knowing already like a third of the incoming class, I was not going to do well because I would be too excited that we were all there. It would just be a great big old party. And so between that and needing to get out of Maine, I just recognized that it was time for me to go. Like my time here felt you know, that chapter had ended. I was looking at schools around, and my parents have been paying into a college tuition program. And so Florida State University ended up being the cheapest, not the cheapest, but it was the most affordable option. And it was the best. It basically was the intersection of the best school that I got into and most affordable one. And I was like, I also knew that I was so full of myself as an 18-year-old. I was like, I need to remove myself from my familiar context to see if I am actually cool. And I am. No, but going to Florida State was a huge upheaval of the senses in my, you know, perceptions of the world. I, you know, Maine's not a very culturally diverse place or ethnically diverse. Going to FSU was better, even though it is a primarily white institution. It was in the panhandle in Florida, and got to interact with different cultures there, different ethnicities that I wouldn't have if I stayed in Bremen. No knock on Bremen, but Bremen's diversity score is a little low right now. And so that was an education that I really wanted. Just the education of being out in the world and being around different people, different perspectives. But then suddenly I was around 40,000 people between the ages of 18 and 25, which I was so ramped up about, because it's a huge school, huge Southern football school, like great academics. It was really fast. I learned so much there. I'm so glad that I went, because I learned a lot about who I was. But while I was there, you know, there would be like Tuesday parties where it was just like the water polo team was having a hog roast. we would just go. It was like Tuesday night. It was just loose as a goose. You know, we were all getting silly. And I started as a psych major and then realized, you know, I was getting back to basics and realized at some point I was like, I would like to start writing again. And, you know, took a intro to poetry course. And it was like someone had knocked down a dam. And I was like, this is it. I remember turning in my first poem and was like, that was sick. I just blew the doors off of it. And the first poem I turned into that class was a poem called This Is My Forever. And it was about how I was going to be a lasting figure in poetry, and that poetry is just going to be my life. I mean, it was pretty ego-driven. I think the first lines were, I skillfully spill soliloquy after soliloquy, silky sea. It was very like Dr. Seussian in its flow. But I remember walking out of that class being like, this is it. I need to always do this. And from then I always had. I found spoken word poetry. I became the membership chair of the spoken word poetry organization, Poetic Lyricism, at Florida State University. And that's where I started actually kind of teaching and running workshops. I would run it with our general body, with our members. And we would host shows that would range up to 1,000 people, which was insane. It was just a really fabulous time. Unfortunately, I don't believe the organization exists anymore. So that's been a really sad thing. But yeah, all of that, I realized that I want to do this. And then as I was leaving, I got to study with some fabulous poets there. Virgilio Suarez, one of the first Cuban-American poets to teach at the university. Kerry James Evans, a really fabulous poet in his own right. And David Kirby, who's been nominated for the National Book Award and is just a force unto himself. David Kirby has been a really fabulous influence on me. And while I was working with them, I won my first poetry award. I won the FSU's Poetry Literati Award my senior year. And so, I mean, it was just a lot of validation, and I knew my path, and I was like, I'm always going to write. I don't know where it's going to take me, but I got a degree in creative writing and then a dual degree in creative writing and political science with a concentration in homeland security and emergency management. So all over the place, but you know, it certainly shaped who I was. It actually helped me going to such a big school gave me the confidence that I could go anywhere.
This is the Next Wave Radio Hour from WERU.
You found that commitment to poetry when you were in school, and a lot of people don't know yet where they're going. And so I'm wondering how, knowing what it was you wanted to do, what it was like kind of finding your way from there. Was it still difficult? How did things come together?
I remember we were about to graduate. I had just won the Poetry Literati Award, and I was over the moon. It was for a chapbook. It was called like Animus Meme, which is funny, about the internet and American history. But finding my way after that step, it was really funny to feel the high of graduation, the high of like these recent writing achievements. I'd also published that poem, This Is My Forever, in the school literary review. And I just didn't know. I felt a lot of sadness and like not knowing how to move forward with that. But I also knew that after I graduated high school, that I went and traveled. I went to Costa Rica, went to Central America, and you know, lived in the jungle there near on the Osa Peninsula for a while with my dear friend Ben Shute. And I was like, let's do that again. I need to get out. I've just been in the Southeast. You know, I've been lucky enough to like drive, but used to make the pilgrimage from Maine to Florida every year, which was really cool. I got to experience the East Coast. I found myself returning to that feeling of like, I need to go travel again. And so I had some friends that had taught abroad, the Erskine family who runs Next Cali Blues, you know, dear friends and their kids. And I had seen them travel and I was like, why don't I go and do that? Cause then I also want to teach English. You know, I also want to do something to, you know, I want to travel, but I also want to further, you know, my career. And I remember talking with Peter Skin, and he was like, yeah, man, you got to do it. He's like, absolutely. He's like, you got to go over there. You got to travel. But you also, you know, this is a great thing because it's like you're expanding your horizons by traveling, but you're also broadening your resume by going and teaching. And so I went and lived in Asia for about a year, in Ho Chi Minh City specifically, in Vietnam. And wow, what a culture shock. And so finding my way into that was not a logical progression, but it was logical, but it didn't dawn on me at first. It was like a lengthy process figuring out where I wanted to go. I was pretty much at the point where I could have just thrown a dart on a map and was like, but I looked up where it was like the, you know, the most beautiful and the cheapest to live, and you know, where teachers got paid the best, and Vietnam was all those things. And I would go and to Thailand for a while. Lived on Koh Tao, which is an island in the Gulf of Thailand, for a few months. Got my advanced open water diving certificate, and just it was just a fabulous time. But it was really, again, it was really hard. And so I recommend to anyone going to really large, if you're from a small town, go sit in a large city for a little while and see what happens to you. You know, yeah. You can just it'll rock your world, and it rocked mine. The only time I had seen being so congested as the traffic in Ho Chi Minh City was watching the Alewives run here in Damariscotta, and or in Newcastle rather, or Novoboro. Well, I guess all through those towns. There's, you know, rush hour was so tightly packed on motorbikes navigating the streets of Ho Chi Minh City. People were spilling onto the sidewalks and going over. Like, I just was suddenly in the middle of this cultural inferno that was beautiful, but also I felt this growing feeling that I missed home.
What brought you back to Maine, and what did that feel like when you first arrived?
I think I had been in Asia for 9 months at that point, and I was on a visa run, which I was teaching on a tourist visa, which is a common practice over there, because most the teaching English as a second language pipeline is a pretty transient one. And so people are, you know, in and out, and the process to get a work visa over there is pretty lengthy. So anyway, I would go to Thailand for like a couple of weeks and come back to Vietnam. And so I was in those transitions when I met someone on an airplane and asked them on a date, and then they were just, they were there from the States, and they left, and I really like found that I cared about them, and they went back to the States, and it was at the same time where I was missing home, and I was like, you know, I think maybe it's my time to go too. And it was really cool, because I got to, whenever I travel other places, I get to see other friends. And so I, flying from Vietnam, I landed and saw my friends in California. I just missed being in a place where I spoke the language well, you know, and being in Vietnam, as enlightening as it was, my Vietnamese never got good enough where I felt like I was allowed in on the encrypted connections around me. So, you know, and that's hard. Vietnamese is hard. Learning another language is difficult. And I, you know, am so impressed with people who are just these polyglots or, you know, these songbirds that can listen to something and be like, oh yeah, that's how you do this. And like, I love that about people. It's not me. Language is hard for me. Even English is just like, my relationship with words is just, you know, always evolving. So being in a place where I didn't understand any of the words, other than sometimes when my students were cheating, they were yelling like the answer across the room and spelling it out in Vietnamese. aside from that, like, my Vietnamese wasn't very good. So coming back home, I missed, maybe it was comfortable. Maybe it was like a year of sort of like discomfort and not being rooted anywhere. I missed my parents too. You know, it was the first time I'd missed Christmas that year. And I remember that Christmas, I wanted to be near friends so badly that some of the teachers that I learned how to, we went through an ESL certification together. They were living in a 40-story building. And I remember going there and my phone died. And I like walked up each flight of stairs, and like, it took me like 2 or 3 hours. It wasn't even 40. It was like, you know, 17, 18 flights. Their stories, but I like went around each floor to try to find this person's dorm, and it took me like 2 hours, and I had a crate of beer and like snacks, and I was dripping sweat, and I was like, I will be damned if I will be alone on Christmas. And that, I think that's the feeling, is that like I felt like alone a lot in Vietnam, which wasn't a bad thing. I did some great things for my writing. You know, I've never truly alone. I always have, you know, the muse of my work. But that's why I came back to Maine and started bartending again over here at Schooner Landing, and eventually moved to Portland. And then the pandemic hit. Not before, though, I had applied to graduate schools around the country, because I knew I wanted to teach, and I also knew I wanted to write. And so I was lucky enough to get in everywhere that I applied, but UNH offered me the same amount of money as schools in Boston, and Boston's infinitely more expensive than Dover, New Hampshire. And UNH also promised that I get to teach poetry. And so then I made the trek down to Dover. But I started my program in the thicket of COVID, which was really disorienting and difficult. But in a strange way, it was also the only way that I can imagine I would have done that, because I felt like we were all in something together, my students and I. It's like, and the rest of the campus, it's like the world's falling apart, but you know what we do have? We have each other, even if it's through Zoom. But I loved that. Because I needed my students as much as I think maybe they needed me, or maybe not. Maybe I just needed my students. I needed that community of like people who are also going through the death of normalcy. And that was fantastic. It was really hard. And I remember I would start each class, not each class, but as in each semester, with poetry is about making big things feel, putting them in small spaces. And so the first thing we're going to do is we're going to write a haiku about our COVID experience so far. And some of the most devastating phrases and words I've ever seen put together came out of those prompts and from those students. And I love them all so dearly and hope that they're all doing well. But yeah, that brought me to UNH, taught there for 3 years, finished my master's, and moved back to Maine and started community journalism at the Lincoln County News, my hometown paper.
Briefly, I wondered if you had expected teaching to become such a part of your life, or if that surprised you. Because it sounds like poetry and writing has been with you for a long time.
Yeah. My middle school choir teacher, Anne Marie D'Amico, who is retiring this year. My gosh, I don't know how long she's been there, but what an amazing human. I love Anne Marie so much. She's retiring this year, but Anne Marie, after I graduated from Grace Hall Bay, where she teaches, I remember seeing her at like an academy, and she said to me, she's like, "Jonathan, I had a dream that you were a teacher." And I thought, I was like, that's funny. But something about her saying that, I always have done well with groups of people and wanting to be around them and helping create. I had a really beautiful childhood, and I had a really, you know, I've seen what function looks like, and like, it irks me when I walk into environments where it's not healthy. And I'm like, we can easily fix this. It's so easy. I feel like it's work, but it's easy to be like, to let people know that like you're in a good space. And I just knew that part of teaching is always came naturally. And so it dawned on me that I might be a teacher at some point. I didn't know what capacity, but I was good at it. And, you know, not to toot my own horn, but a little bit, I think you know when you're doing something well, and I felt like I was doing that well. And but it's easier for me with poetry because it's an art. Like, you know, give a shit about the grammatical structures of what's happening. It's more about like how we're accessing you and like how you show up for the page. And it just becomes more about a class about people than it does about poetry. And ultimately, you know, poetry is not necessarily a product so much as it is a lens to view your life. And the poetry is all around, you know. There's a quote about, you know, that nothing is beautiful, but in that we make the poetry out of it, and it's our job to make it poetry, you know. In poetry, blood is blood, but outside of that, it's just red. And so that's our job as poets. Poetry is a choice. And I, you know, tell my students that, like, you know, go see the sunset. Wake up a little early, wake up late, go get drunk, don't get drunk, go just like embrace the things that make you happy and even the ones that make you sad. And both are important. And being in that journey with my students is exactly that. I was with them in that journey, you know, because as much, you know, teaching is sometimes just a reminder of the things that we're supposed to be doing too. And I'm not always great about running to the sunset or going swimming when I feel like it. But being a teacher, I had to bring the best parts of myself, because that's what my students deserved. And so I didn't know that it was going to be a big part of my life, but it just sort of, again, seemed like a shoe that fit very well.
This is the Next Wave Radio Hour from WERU. Today's episode is with host Elizabeth Walstoney and guest Jonathan Riley.
Well, you said something as you were talking about that, which I recognized for myself. You said that you know when you're doing something well, or when you're doing something that kind of makes sense for who you are. Mm-hmm. And I always knew that I wanted to write, but I didn't really have, and I knew that I liked to talk to people too, but I didn't have plans or know how to make plans to build my life around it. So it kind of just happened, I think, because I was fortunate to be able to follow the things that I felt like I knew how to do. And it kind of grew into being able to pursue that. And from listening to you talk, it sounds like that's part of how your life has gone too, that you've followed the things you love and the things you know how to do, which sounds like a greeting card now that I'm saying it out loud. But from the perspective of the program that we're on today, that's about people finding their way and making it work in Maine, is that an approach that you would recommend for other people?
I don't know. Following the things that you love is a path. And it's a path I've taken often. You know, I followed love back from Vietnam, and I followed, you know, love of writing all over. Now, I think about the poets, the famous poets, like Carlos Williams, who was a doctor as well as a poet. And I think about how poetry could and can fit into my life in other ways, and how these other passions of mine could possibly fit in my life in different ways. And while, you know, maybe I could have pursued a different trade, one of my favorite, if not my favorite poet, is John Ashbery. And one of the last interviews John Ashbery did was, he was asked, like, did you make a lot of money from your poetry? And for context, John Ashbery's won, short of the Nobel Prize in Literature, he was at one, you know, he was at one point the most awarded living American poet. So there's like not many people who have higher accolades than John Ashbery. And he said, no, not at all. He's like, but what it did was it opened the door for me to teach. And it opened my doors to make money doing other things. So I wouldn't pursue your passions lightly. You know, it's hard for me to recommend it, but I also can't imagine having done it any other way. I wouldn't like to be doing something else. You know, I do sometimes bartend. I don't want it to be my full-time job. I think the passions thing is like it's a really interesting thought. You know, I'm 29 and I'm thinking about how the next 30 years will go, the next 29. And I'm wondering, you know, so what, where do my passions and affinities fit into that? When does the practical overtake the passionate? And does it? Do I allow it? And so that's a really important thing, because, you know, one of my favorite lines from a rapper that I listened to a lot in high school was basically about, like, you know, money isn't everything, but what's a family of five if you can't afford it? Meaning that, like, you need to make ends meet in some way, shape, or form. And I've been lucky enough to do that. I've made, like, as far as poetry goes, I've made a lot of money from my poetry. You know, in the world of poetry, I had to file a T99 I won poetry awards. You know, that were enough money. I had to declare them on my taxes. Like, great. I mean, I'm not rolling the dough, but. That
but
was,
in the writing world, that is.
Yeah, right.
You know, that's astonishing.
It's astonishing. Right? I've made, you know, from my poetry, if you don't count my teaching, you know, I've made, you know, there are some poetry awards where you win like 10, 20, 30 grand, you know, 50 grand. You know, I haven't made that much, but I've made a few thousand dollars from, you know, the awards, strictly just from the awards and the publication things that I've gotten, which is great. You know, that's just, but that's not the path. You can't sustain something on that. But you don't do it for the money. So I would say, in deciding what you will do with your life and as you move through it, if you aren't actively in something, the thing that makes you money isn't your passion, I really hope deeply that you are creating space for whatever does bring you life and joy. And journalism, community journalism, has become, I've watched it become a bit of a passion, and like I'm feeling a lot more involved in it. It's all the best parts of writing. Writing is a very solitary endeavor, but not necessarily in community journalism. I mean, sitting down and writing the actual thing, but yeah, you know, like with poetry, it's mostly just me going to poetry readings and, you know, bearing my emotions to, you know, maybe hopefully a crowded room. But in community journalism, I mean, every week we put in a paper that has like a 10, 15,000, you know, circulation, that affects the community. And that's become maybe more important than my own like passions. You know, it's the, like, it's become, what does my work do? What does my passion do other than it being self-serving? Like, and right now it feels like my writing, and so the question, if you're going to be a writer and artist, like, what do you want your art to do? And if the answer is just for yourself to like process the world as you go through it, that's a totally fine and beautiful answer. But at some point, the big transition for artists is when you move outside of yourself. And so it was discussed in one of my poetry workshops. You know, it's not a universal truth, but I believe that. And I think that one of the greatest outcomes of writing is to positively affect and build a community. And so I've come around to the idea of what my passions do. And so following the things that you're good at, sure. But I really hope deeply that you are making art or something. Maybe your art is going to the gym. Maybe your art is going for a swim. Maybe it's just being a beautiful conversationalist. Maybe it's making someone feel great in a coffee shop, you know, over conversation. Maybe it's just listening really beautifully. I wonder, whatever you do, I hope you do it beautifully. That's what I would say to Mainers who are coming and going, whether they want to come back here. And I am lucky to be back here. Will I stay here forever? I don't know. But it's nice to be around my parents, my family, and my community to try to give back and help build a little bit of the magic that I was able to experience while I was growing up here.
I'm curious, as you're looking ahead at the next years of your life, where you think you might go, not necessarily in a geographical sense, but, you know, whatever direction in your life, and what things are guiding you as you do that.
Yeah, that's a thing that I've been moving through as well. I feel really good in my position with the paper. And so I foresee myself here for a while. However, there are outside interests of mine related to my faith, Unitarian Universalism, which is, for those that don't know, is it's a pluralistic approach to faith traditions. Unitarian Universalism basically just believes in the individual's pursuit of truth, responsible pursuit of truth, whatever form that may take. So you can be a Buddhist or a Jew or a Catholic and still be a Unitarian Universalist. It's sort of a supplemental religion. But there's something about the humanism of Unitarian Universalism that really draws me in. And I see my abilities to write and congregate and be involved in a community being incredibly useful to a faith tradition that's pretty young as far as religions go. And so there was a time I did apply to divinity school a while ago. I applied to Harvest Divinity School. I got an interview, but I didn't end up going. And that was heartening and disheartening. But that notion of constructing meaningful community spiritually, with that being the intention, you know, people do that all the time, just as like being a really beautiful and wonderful coach in sports, you know, having a really wonderful teacher, you know, you're informing the spirituality of individuals already. So I am interested, though, in the act of writing and studying it in the context of religion, wondering how does it fit into the scope of identity formation. I learned, and that's purely from my own perspective, I learned a lot about who I am sitting down and writing. And in that act of writing, I figured out things I needed to do. And so I'm interested in studying the act of identity formation through writing, how that translates in the classroom, how that translates into a congregation. And that's an interest of mine. And so does that mean that I'll become a Unitarian Universalist minister? I don't know. Maybe it's in the cards someday. But it seems to be an incredible intersection of the things that I am good at. I love being around people, love helping people through their own circumstances, because that's the thing. If you get through it, you get to help someone else. That's the trade. You get through it. Whatever it is, I feel as though you have an obligation to turn and help the next person through it. And so it makes sense to me to capitalize on those desires in the future. But divinity school is not a seminary. I wouldn't be going to work. It's not a vocation necessarily. It's more of the academic approach to divinity, and rather than the vocational approach. Yeah. So maybe eventually I'll get my master's in divinity. Maybe Harvard will take me back, but there are a lot of really wonderful schools around the nation. That seems like a faraway thought right now, but it's funny. Community journalism, working at the Lincoln County News, has been the most intense by far academic pursuit that I've ever been a part of, producing 7 to 12 articles that range from 300 to 1200 words a week. It's fantastic. There is no course load that scares me. There's no syllabus that could really, you know, deter me. They're like, I'm like, oh, you have to produce one essay a week. Like, oh, is that it? Sick. Yeah. Oh, I can do that in my sleep. My own thoughts. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I get to sleep. Yeah. Great. That's fantastic.
So we've gone through and gone into some parts of most of your life. I wish that we had hours to talk, but as we're kind of coming to the end of this conversation, I was wondering if there are any reflections or conclusions or even advice that you might want to share from what you've learned so far.
I feel like every week I have a variety of thoughts and lessons that I'm learning. And this week I recognize that curiosity is a form of love. And being in this community, reporting, being curious is, you know, is a way to say and show love. In your personal life, you know, asking your partner how they are, asking your friends what's going on, asking them about what they're doing, you know, that's love. And I think, you know, when people say that the world needs more love, it kind of just like, it lacks instruction. It's like, here's the product, is that we need more love. Like, okay, cool. So what does that mean? Does that mean that we go to therapy? We go in one big, you know, therapy session together? Are we just like kinder? So for me, I think that my advice to not just young people, but to everyone is that remember that curiosity is love, and being curious about the world, being curious about the people will endear you to both. And the road paved with kindness is much smoother than the one paved in anger. And it's really hard to be angry if you're curious all the time.
My name is Pepin Middlehauser, and this has been the Next Wave Radio Hour. I want to give a huge thank you to one of the new hosts of Next Wave Radio Hour, Elizabeth Wallstoney, and also to her guest today, Jonathan Riley. You can find out more about Jonathan and see some of his poetry by going to Instagram and following him at j.j.riley. That's J.J. Riley on Instagram. Thank you also to the Maine Community Foundation for supporting this program. Our theme music is by Zeke Zacharitas. Today's episode was edited and produced by me, Pepin Middlehauser. You can find the archive of this and every other episode of Next Wave at weru.org, and as a podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and pretty much everywhere else you can get podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email nextwaveradio@weru.org. I would absolutely love to hear from you. Next Wave Radio Hour airs on the fourth Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. Until next time, take care of yourself, okay? Okay.